Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I recently spoke with Patricia McLaughlin about her book, The People's Post Office, The History and Politics of the Japanese Postal System, 1871 to 2010, and that came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2011. Now, this is a book that's about the history of an institution that we don't typically think of, or many of us probably don't typically think of in its connection with the history of politics, and that is the Postal Service. McLaughlin's book does a really wonderful job of not just pulling out really wonderful personal stories about individual postal commissioners, looking at the significance of postal commissioners and other members of the postal service in Japan to the sort of ebbs and flows of the Japanese political system over the 19th and 20th century, and also looking at the ongoing ramifications of 20th century political reforms for Japan today. It's a fascinating book. I learned a ton from reading it, and I hope you'll enjoy listening to our conversation about it. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Carla.
We're here today at New Books in East Asian Studies to talk with Patty McLaughlin about her new book, The People's Post Office, The History and Politics of the Japanese Postal System, 1871 to 2010. And that just came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2011. Thank you so much for joining us today, Patty.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Well, it's I just want to say to start us off how much I learned from this book. I am, you know, a historian of East Asia, but China. I learned so much, including aspects of the history of Japan that I didn't realize I didn't know anything about. So it was just, it was really enlightening in all kinds of ways. And thank you so much for making the time.
Well, thank you.
So, Patty, can you start us off a little bit by just saying a little bit about what brought you to the study of Japan, actually, in the first place?
Well, it's interesting that you should be asking this question coming from UBC, because it was as a student at UBC that I got interested in Japan. So I got my bachelor's degree at UBC. I was born and raised there in Vancouver. And I didn't know what I wanted to do at first, but started moving into Asian studies classes through political science while I was there. And after about a year, I took a class in Japanese and Chinese history. And I got the bug, and I studied Japanese the following summer. And then as a political science student, I decided I would combine my interest with the social sciences and my growing interest in Japan. And as you know, it's a great place to study East Asia. No epiphany in the cradle. It was more a series of fortuitous events, including one guest speaker I had in one class that I'll never forget. I can remember what he's wearing in my mind's eye. And he stood before us and said that if you could combine knowledge of Japanese with a marketable degree, you stand to do very well in life. And this was the 80s when Japan was really taking off. And I thought, I'll try that and I'll start Japanese. And it, of course, ended up being much harder than I ever thought it could be. And I invested so much time in it that I just kept following that road. And this is where it got me. So being at UBC really was the key, I think, for me.
Excellent. So here's now a little plug for Asian studies and Asian history at UBC. This has been a public service announcement. So, Patty, how did you get, I know this is not your first book, you've published widely before this. So how did you get from your first projects to, this is your second book, is that right?
It's my second single-authored book, that's right.
So how did you get from the first monograph project to this one?
Well, there is a connection. I've always been interested in sort of groups in Japan that aren't in the mainstream. Or that little about which little is known. And my first book was on consumers in Japan. And I was very interested in looking at how consumers mobilized, how they put pressure on government, their role in the policy process and in the legal system. And it was that book was in part a reaction to the the hot topics of the time when I was in graduate school, because that, of course, came out of my dissertation, which was industrial policy and political economy and government business relations. And I wanted to look at the people who were left behind by the political mainstream. And in that research, I learned a lot about the post office. I learned about how consumers with their savings gravitated toward postal savings. And I learned about how the post office was this interesting place that provided so many services for ordinary Japanese. And it was also at that time that I began to get a bit of an understanding of how important the political system or the post office system and the postmasters in general were in Japanese politics, but so very little was known about it. So once that book was finished, and I was fishing around for a second project, I always had in the back of this mind, the post office. Maybe I could do something with the post office. But I kind of sat on it for a long time because in the field of political science, I couldn't figure out a way to spin it to make it a real political science book. And as it turns out, it's very interdisciplinary. And I just followed my interests rather than make it a piece of positivist social science research. So there really was this connection, looking at the post office through the eyes of the consumers, and then turning it around and figuring out how did the post office actually figure in Japanese mainstream politics. And they really do, although in a way that's not always well understood by political analysts.
Right. Or by readers. I mean, this was something, or at least not after the book, but prior to coming to the book, I had no idea of this connection between the Japanese political system and any aspect of the Japanese political system. And so that was one of the most fascinating and surprising parts of this story. And so the at least for me, who's coming from a very different subfield, it was fascinating to read about this. And this brings us into the book itself. And so you actually bring us into the book in the preface in this really wonderful way by, I think, really making very clear to the reader in a way that's extraordinarily engaging how your personal interests and briefly put, you're clearly fascinated with this topic, and it comes through in the writing. And so it opens up in the preface with a story or a vignette in which you arrive in Tokyo with your family in summer, and you sort of, you're exhausted, and you go out to get groceries and get lost on the coming on the way back, and run into this postmaster who very kindly sort of, and very kind of silently almost, right, like leads you back home and shows you the way in. And this, I think, it's a wonderful, wonderful way to start the book. So for readers, I'll just say very briefly, or for listeners rather, who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, this is a book that's very much about the kind of this seeming oddness between, on the one hand, the sort of traditional kind of, you call it, institutional stickiness of the postal system in Japan. At the same time, the really sort of, in ways, dramatic changes within the postal system that happened throughout the mid to late 20th century. Right. And you do this by looking at a connection of, or a combination of institutions, political leaders, and the role of many, many factors that contributed to this history and this change. Okay, so laying that out for listeners, that's what we're talking about. You tell us in the preface about the vast array of research materials that were brought to bear in creating this story and in doing this research and writing this book. These incorporated archival work and newspapers and interviews. Can you say a little bit about the research process that led you to this story?
Sure, that's a good question. And it was hard at first because the postal system's role in politics, and particularly the role of the postmasters in mobilizing the vote behind the former ruling party, the Liberal Democratic Party, was so secretive that much of the story that I hoped to get was hidden. So my first few weeks in doing this research, particularly before I went to Japan, was really wheel spinning and a lot of dead ends. And I'm just thankful that I did this study when I did, because as a result of a series of scandals involving the post office and more media attention to the post office, there's a lot of newspaper coverage of how it works now. So in the end, I was able to piece together a chronology of developments in the postal system, political in particular, and economic, that was in part based on archival work involving newspapers. So that was an important part of the book. That just sort of gave me the raw data. I also depended a lot on conversations with postmasters, and that was also sometimes difficult to secure. A lot of postmasters wouldn't speak with me. They were very suspicious. They're a very clubbish, tightly knit group, very proud, very dignified, and very silent, sometimes for good reason. And I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to talk about that a little bit later. So I met a lot of postmasters in the archives, because a lot of them have ended up after retirement being amateur historians and researching postal history, etc., and befriended a couple of them, had some good conversations with them in that setting in the weeks that I spent sitting in an archive. I also interviewed a few, and I interviewed some in the Tokyo area, in the Kamakura area, and then I traveled a couple of times for a few days each time to Kyushu. I was interested in seeing how the post office integrated into less urban environments in Japan, and I had an opportunity to see that in Kyushu, which where the post office is very strong and the postmaster is politically very powerful. So that was also very insightful. I was also privileged that a few books have come out, memoirs by postmasters, which is new because there's a kind of cold of silence surrounding the postmasters and their activities. And when that was broken a little bit by some kind of renegade postmasters, their resources ended up being very important as well to the research. And there are also lots of postmasters' internal histories, which I managed to obtain, a few of them. And interviews with reporters. That was really, really interesting. People who work for the major newspapers on the postal beat, as I would call it in the book, who had to follow around the postal system, basically the postmasters, for 3 years or however long before their next transfer to a new area. They really knew the post office inside and out, and they were able to give me some really, really interesting information on how this worked. So the empirical data comes from a number of different sources, and it took me many years to collect it and piece it together and fill in holes. And then I supplemented it. Of course, there's a base of more general theoretical background in institutions, et cetera, and interest groups and the political economic development of Japan that sort of lays the foundations of the work. But the most fun I had was really talking to postmasters. That was like entry into a different world for me, because they are so traditional and they try to keep their traditional values alive. These are postmasters who were the sons and grandsons and sometimes great grandsons of post offices that had been set up generations before, or postmasters that had started their businesses many, many generations before. And they really did try to carry on the customs and practices of their grandfathers and great grandfathers, businesses, and watching how that worked and their frustrations and pride was really one of the most interesting parts of doing this research.
Are there any interviews in particular that stand out to you as being particularly interesting or fun or surprising or in whatever way that really stick out immediately to you in your mind?
Yeah, there were a few, and I interviewed a few of these postmasters several times. But two in particular I really enjoyed. One was a postmaster who had retired. He's a retired postmaster, and they're also very much involved in political mobilization and electoral affairs. And I met him in a communications archive in the Otemachi district of Tokyo. And after a while, we strike up conversations during tea time or lunch, and he became very friendly and very helpful. At the time, he was in his mid-70s, and I asked if I could come out and see his post office. He wasn't at the post office anymore. He'd run this post office from his house and then built another post office in front of his home. And when he retired, because he didn't have any sons to take over the post office, he handed it over to one of his favorite employees. And this is a commissioned post office. And he invited me out after I pressured him a little. And I spent a day with him and I met his wife. I met him. And he took me through a tour of the post office. I met the employees. But what was really interesting about this man, and I talk about him at the beginning of one of the chapters, I think it's chapter 4, was the head of an association of retired postmasters that was something of a fan club for the founder of the post office. This was a Meiji era bureaucrat named Maejima Hisoka. And Maejima is the bureaucrat emblazoned on some of the 1 and 2 yen. Actually, I think the value of the stamps were worth more in the 80s, but emblazoned on some of the stamps that were circulating in the 1980s. And he's buried in the Yokohama area. And on the occasion of his birthday, groups of postmasters will go and visit his grave. And this postmaster would take some of these tours to the grave. And to me, it was just a really interesting insight on how these postmasters have tried to keep Meiji era history alive in their post office. And this particular postmaster made no bones about telling me how this use of history and this reinvention of history was used for political purposes to try to drum home to the Japanese at a time when the post office was under threat, how important the post office was in the modernization of Japan and the dissemination of traditional values. And so that one was a really, really interesting opportunity for me. And also my visits to Kyushu, I befriended a couple of postmasters and spent several days with them. And they told me a lot of secrets about their postal system, things that I wasn't supposed to know about how they gathered the vote behind the LDP and the mechanisms that they used in order to do that. So I got to know Kyushu a little better at that time. And I also got to know some of these postmasters and understood more intimately, I think, the social networks that really imbibe the postal system. A lot of these postmasters were married to the daughters of some of their colleagues. Their sons and daughters would enter into the postal system. And their post offices were often in their homes. They're still run this way in a lot of small communities. And it was one of the highlights of my trips and my visits. And I took two extended trips to Kyushu to be with these postmasters, and I'm still grateful to them.
That sounds wonderful. And actually, it brings us into something that we can kind of work back to the introduction, but it brings us into, for listeners who may not have yet had a chance to read the book, but hopefully will after listening to this interview, because it's fascinating.
That would be great.
yes. So you're talking about these Japanese postmasters and bringing up sort of incidentally facts like, you know, some of them worked out of their houses and connection with politics. Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with the idea of who these postmasters are, and can you kind of start us off a little bit by saying a little bit about, can you say a little bit about the early history of this institution of the commissioned post office?
Sure.
And who are these postmasters and who gets to be a postmaster? And we can kind of move from there.
Absolutely. The position of the commissioned post office, although it wasn't called that at the time, the Japanese term today is Tokutei Yubin Kyokucho. And I've translated as commissioned postmasters. Sometimes they're called special postmasters, but they extend back to the early Meiji period in the early to mid 1870s when that bureaucrat, Mr. Maejima, I talked about a few moments ago, was in the thick of introducing many of the institutions of the postal system, including the mail service and the postal saving system, which he introduced in 1875. And at the time, he was very concerned about how the state was going to set up a network of post offices around the country when it really had no resources to do so. So he had this idea, which he borrowed in part from the British system, to commission local businessmen or local dignitaries in particular to carry out the business of the post office from their own homes. So these early postmasters weren't bureaucrats. They were private citizens that were contracted to the state to carry out these functions. And the requirements for becoming a postmaster at the time were much different than the requirements for becoming a regular postmaster in a large post office in an urban center, even in the Meiji era, in which you had to rise through the ranks of the bureaucracy and take a series of often difficult exams. These commissioned postmasters simply had to be residents of the neighborhoods that they were to serve. They had to be literate at the time. They had to be well-educated. They had to be good at accounting. And they had to have the finances to set up the post office from their own homes or business. And they were usually the sons or grandsons of Japan's sort of now disaffected lower tier of low-ranking aristocrats, people like village headmen, former samurai, that had lost their aristocratic luster as a result of the Meiji era and the Meiji era reforms. Everyone's a commoner at this time. The old sort of ranking system has disappeared, at least in theory. And my Maijima very presciently understood that this was a tier of people who had the status in their local communities that would enable the state to establish the post office and gain the trust of those locals within their communities. So basically, they came from the stratum of society known as meiboka, that a lot or local level notables, so local nobles, or men of distinction, as it's sometimes translated, that other Meiji historians have spoken about. And the Meiji state was aware of this in other areas. They realized that these people, this stratum, could serve as an intermediary between the old Tokugawa era and the new Meiji period, between the local areas and the state, which was still trying to extend its reach throughout the country. And Maijima kind of hit on this trend in the Meiji state, and he built on it in building the Meiji post office system. And as it turned out, the meiboka, the men of distinction, were all too happy to jump on board. It was a way for them to gain stature or shore up their old stature in local areas. And they used the position sometimes as a jumping board to local politics or to set up new businesses or to expand their businesses. So many of these early post offices were actually in local politics at the time or local administration, and many of them ran their own private businesses. And what's really interesting, and I think it's a telling statement about how important the allure of status was of the post office, these postmasters provided their postal services free of charge. They didn't gain any salary. They could gain commission off the sale of post office stamps, but they did not become rich becoming post offices. They saw in the becoming postmasters, they saw in the post offices an opportunity to elevate their status to a higher level, hopefully. And that in turn could serve as sort of capital to another sphere of public life or business life. So these become the vaunted commissioned postmasters of the post war period. There are many renditions of them. They're reformed on many occasions. By the time 1945 comes around, there are two kinds of postmasters. There are the descendants of these first postmasters who inherit their positions, and there are locals. They are members of the communities that they serve. And then there's this tier, a much smaller tier of bureaucrats who run the very large ordinary postmasters, which are far fewer in number. And those are the ones that function like ordinary bureaucrats. In the post-war era under the occupation, the American forces decided that all postmasters should become bureaucrats, and they all are subject to the same rules and regulations. And they're also banned from participating in election activities at this time. Some customs don't change amongst the now commissioned postmasters. For instance, they're still chosen from their local communities. And although some sort of pretext to making them take the exams like the ordinary postmasters is introduced, for all intents and purposes, they need to be vetted by other local postmasters, sometimes by local conservative politicians, and they still need to be members of their own communities, preferably people who have grown up in these communities. So they're a very different tier from the ordinary post office. And today there are about 19,000 postmasters, and until the privatization of the post office began in 2007, there were about more than 19,000, closer to 20,000, 19,000 commissioned postmasters and about 1,200 ordinary postmasters. So the commissioned postmasters by far outweigh the ordinary postmasters. And it's through the commissioned postmasters that you see this dissemination of tradition, and it really has, it really is testament to the postmasters' historical evolution and the nature of their founding and the rules and norms in which they are hired and in which they develop.
And for listeners who may not be familiar with this institution, these postmasters are not just in charge of delivering the mail, right? And this is one of the interesting things about this system, is that there are all kinds of other sort of social welfare and local services that are being provided. Right. So can you talk a little bit about those? Because that's one of the things that comes out of, I think, this really wonderful chapter in which Maijima kind of sets up the system that has just really longstanding ramifications. So what else are they doing at these postal services?
Well, that's a good point. So all post offices, ordinary or commissioned, carry out the three main services of the post office, which is, of course, mail delivery, the postal savings system, and the postal insurance system. The postal savings system, which was introduced in 1875 and based on, again, British model, and other continental European countries also have postal savings systems in place at this time or later in the 19th century. The postal savings system becomes extremely important because it raises much of the funds that's used by the pre-war government, from Meiji through the early Showa governments, to fund economic development and military expansion. And in the post-war era, it still becomes the main source of a large fund called the Fiscal Investment and Loan Program in Japan, which is like a second budget, a non-tax-based budget for the government that's used for industrial development, public works projects, funding for small and medium enterprises, even environmental protection, et cetera, et cetera. And so the postmasters collect a significant portion of postal savings, which comprised at its peak in the post-war era, one quarter to one third of household savings. And it's the largest bank in the world even today. And the post office also carries out, of course, this postal insurance system, which is a life insurance system. And more people are insured by the post office than any other private firm. So it's also a very large program, a social welfare program. And proceeds from that service as well go into the Fiscal Investment and Loan Program. But in addition to those three main services, which get the most attention from people who have looked at the post office in the past and from the media, the postal system also plays very deliberately a role that I've likened to an informal social welfare system. And one of the more well-known services is the really informal service that starts to arise in the 70s and 80s, whereby the postal worker on his rounds, the mail carrier, would pick up the postal insurance premium payment or a deposit to the postal savings system, often from elderly residents on their rounds, and be in charge of actually making the deposit for that client and then returning that client's passbook the next day that's been updated. And that eventually sort of segues into a broader program of taking care of the elderly, particularly in remote rural areas where a local government doesn't necessarily have the reach to provide these services itself. And people would put little yellow flags up, and they still do this. They would put yellow flags in their windows to alert the mail carrier that they needed some assistance, and the mail carrier would check on the resident on his or her rounds and sometimes take orders for groceries or medicine orders, and parlay those orders onto vendors in the area, and then a delivery would be made to that local resident. And this proved to be very popular amongst elderly residents, particularly those who couldn't move around themselves. And it's no accident that it begins to develop in the 1980s, and at the time is known as the Himawari service, which means literally a sunflower service, again in rural areas. And this is a time when the post office begins to feel threatened from the movement toward privatization of public enterprise, and from also threatened by critics within the LDP and also economists and other watchers of the post office, who were arguing at that time that the post office needs to be radically reformed and the postal savings system drastically cut back. And but nevertheless, it's become a very, very popular form of social welfare in the local level that really helps knit local communities together. And it's what makes the post office really popular in these rural areas, particularly amongst elderly residents. In addition, and I won't go through all of them because there's so many of them, but there are a lot of other services that come out of the three main services that provide these welfare social services. And one of them was a network of clinics that came out of the social or the postal insurance system. That provided public health services. And they were a very important conduit for the state's dissemination of public health policies, inoculation programs, physicals for soldiers going off to war before 1945, even prenatal care for mothers, and early care for children, early childhood care for children. And in the post-war era, many of these were reformed. A lot of them disappeared, but they became a kind of social center or recreation center for local communities. And there's a network at its peak, close to 100 of them, that served as sort of recreation centers, places for people to gather, sometimes health consultation centers, and again, used disproportionately by the elderly. A lot of them also become inns or hotels and become very controversial because a lot of critics argue, why should the government be running these veritable hotels in competition with the private sector, making money outside of the postal services. So it becomes like a very ambiguous network of organizations, some of which are lauded for providing these social services and others for taking away services that should be provided by the private sector. But those are just a few of the examples that highlight the extent to which the post office becomes really integrated in local communities. And the early architects of the postal system really wanted it to be that way. Maeji Mahisoka, just like the architect of the modern British system, Rowland Hill, looked to the post office in a very progressive manner and looked at it as not only a vehicle for the extension of the modern state, but also for the collection of capital for the state and for a way to integrate ordinary people into the modernization of Japanese society, the dissemination of educational norms and identification with the state, and even the development of patriotism when the occasion arose, particularly during wartime. So it's a multifaceted institution, and I think it is this way, not just because of the foresight of its architects, but because of the timing of its introduction. The post office develops at the same time as the development of the modern state and the modernization of the economy, and therefore assumes these functions that we would not expect in a Canadian or an American postal system.
That's right. And it's so interesting because the what you just described really makes so clear some of the many reasons why this issue of reform of the postal system is about so much more than simply the
right.
Post, right? I mean, it's such a beautifully interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary institution. You wouldn't think, as someone interested in history of medicine or history of public health, that the postal service would be a place to look to for part of the crucial part of this history.
Right. Japan's really unique in that sense, I think.
Really wonderful. And this is, it opened up so many sort of mental doors for me just thinking about that aspect of it. So it's great. Now, you've brought up a couple of times comparisons with the British system, and just for a moment to move just very briefly toward issues of kind of historical craft. One of the things that my students and graduate students, but also colleagues and myself, are really increasingly asking about and interested in are ways to effectively deploy comparison in a local study in a way that adds to the story rather than making it throwing it off track. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that you do really, really well here, and this comes up explicitly in the first couple of the chapters, is to both bring up the British system as a comparative case, but also to justify why it's important to talk about this here and what this adds to the story. So can you, just in terms of methodology and your own choices, can you talk about sort of why you do mention and spend a significant amount of time in the first couple of chapters on the British system and why that's an important part of this story?
Right. Good question. And I grappled a lot with how to integrate the British story into the Japanese story. And I think one of the main reasons why it was important to contextualize the Japanese post office in the British system was that many of the norms and practices and rules and programs of modern postal systems the world over stem from the British modernization of its postal system in 1840, the centralized postal system that developed at that time, and its mail system, and later a postal savings system, and even a brief foray into insurance, but mostly the network of post offices and the functions that a postal system could perform for a government, and also for the public at large. The tradition of postage stamps was the first postage stamp was introduced in 1840. And it was a major innovation because around the world, and including in Britain, when you delivered a letter, when you mailed a letter, often the receiver would have to pay for it. So the idea of prepaid postage didn't become universal in Britain until 1840, and then that norm disseminates in other countries as well. So that's just one small example of just how important Britain was in setting the standards for postal systems in other parts of the world, and Japan was no exception. Britain was a model to Japan. Japan looked closely to Britain, and Maejima Hisoka himself was an Anglophile and was very interested in looking to Britain for a model. And other historians, particularly Eleanor Wesney, have chronicled this really nicely. And so the fact that the Japanese consciously used the British system as a model for its own postal institutions, I think, screamed for attention in this book. It had to be so. But I also found that the British system served as an interesting comparative point for how post offices develop in different ways depending on the stage of history and the role of the state. And that's a major theme in the book. I think the Japanese system is particularly active in the world of Japanese finance, as well as communications, and also in politics, because of the nature of its interaction with the state and the timing of the development of the post office in the state. Now, the British system was a little bit different. The British system didn't play that important role politically that the Japanese system eventually assumes. And I think that had to do with the timing of the state. So I thought that was an interesting story to tell on how both of these, even though one becomes the model to the other, they still are put on different historical trajectories and their political outcomes are very different. So you'll notice that in the book, I talk about how Britain serves as a model for Japanese institutions, but I don't trace the British system to the present time because the trajectory is just so different. I think it warrants a different book. But nevertheless, I think there are areas in which we can contrast Japan and Britain and also show some really interesting similarities. And in so doing, we see how Japan is conforming to international norms, but also breaking away from them. But I don't believe in just sort of pointing out differences. I think they really needed explanation. And my explanation is largely an historical institutional one.
Right. Now you bring up politics, and let's move to that for a little while, because this is such it's such a surprising part of the story for someone who doesn't know much about this institution, and it's such an important part of the rest of the book. Now, starting in chapter two, you describe how in the first decade after World War II, which is a really crucial time for the Japanese postal system, what starts developing is sort of postmasters strengthening and establishing ties to local bureaucrats and local politicians in a way that lays the groundwork for what eventually ramifies into a really strong role of the Postal Service in helping determine the electoral process and in connection in particular with what you've mentioned, the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, for non-specialists who might be listening. This totally fascinates me. Can you talk about how, so I know the whole book about this, so I know it is about this on some level, so I know it's completely unreasonable to ask you to briefly describe how this happens.
Okay.
But I'm going to ask you anyway.
So try to give you the main talking points.
So briefly, how does this happen? How does this connection between the Postal Service and this really strong political role that they go on to have, where does that come from?
Right. The trigger behind the marriage between the postmasters, the commission postmasters in particular, and the Liberal Democratic Party, was one man, Tanaka Kakue. And he recognized an affinity between the postmasters and conservative politicians, which had been a long time in coming. He recognized that a lot of postmasters would link arms with individual politicians and help them in their elections. What he did was make it a systemic relationship, an organizational relationship between the postmasters and their representative associations and the Liberal Democratic Party. And on the push side of the equation, Tanaka Kakue, operating in the 1950s and 60s, but particularly in the 50s when he served as Minister of Post and Telecommunications, was aware that the LDP lacked a strong base of support amongst ordinary people. And one way to overcome that was to establish strong ties with interest groups. And he did this with the farmers. He did this with the construction industry. And he recognized in the postmasters a similar asset for the LDP. And what attracted him to the postmasters was their extensive organization. They had been organized for several generations at that point by the bureaucracy to implement postal functions. And as an occupation, they were very tightly knit. They were well organized. They had their own voluntary sort of lobbying organizations by this time. And they were well networked amongst one another, and they had, more importantly, very, very close ties to the communities in which they served. They were well-known personalities. And so Tanaka thought, there's a network that we can mobilize to gather the vote. Now, he didn't invent it. He just recognized that this was beginning to happen anyway, and he accelerated the process and made it secretly official, to put it in sort of contradictory terms. And so that's really what Tanaka really links the two sides together, and they were moving together anyway. The postmasters were happy to do this, not only because they were ideologically conservative, but also because they were threatened in the early post-war era. They were threatened by postal workers who were radical, militant. They hated the idea of postmasters inheriting their positions rather than granting postmasterships to the most well-trained of their employees. And they viewed the commission postmaster system as this feudal relic from an earlier time that was designed to save the state money, but this was no longer necessary in the post-war era. And these militant postal workers wanted to abolish the commission post office system and turn every post office into an ordinary post office. The commission postmasters didn't want that. They wanted to preserve their institutions and their way of life. And so they saw in this alliance with the LDP a safeguard against extinction. And so this kind of contract emerged between the two sides, whereby the postmaster said, we will give you votes and we'll mobilize members of the party and the individual support organizations of individual politicians. We will raise money for you And we, our wives and our retired colleagues will provide campaign assistance to you. We will do that, even though it's illegal under Japanese law for us as bureaucrats to be involved in politics. But in return, you give us protective policy that preserve our institutions and the public institutions of the post office more generally. So they exchanged votes and other electoral supports for long-term protection, protection from extinction, basically. And that initial exchange continues well into the 80s when the postal workers eventually drop their opposition to the post office and argue that, well, we'll join you and we're now with you. But through the 1980s and beyond, the LDP continues as this really important interest group that's allied closely with the LDP, and it becomes widely recognized as one of the reasons why the LDP is able to stay in power. By the, and I don't want to overstate it because it's the postmasters combined with another a number of other interest groups that provide these services to the LDP. But it was said that during the height of the postmasters' power, they were able to mobilize around 1 million votes behind LDP candidates, particularly in upper house elections. And they did it all behind the scenes, and it was all very quiet, but very, very well organized. And I think a major boon to, in particular, LDP politicians who were connected to telecommunications and the postal system. So it was really the organizational cohesion and networks and expansiveness of the postmaster's presence on a national level that made them attractive to the LDP. And their pressure was one of the reasons why the LDP for so many years was very, very reluctant to introduce any kind of reform to the entire postal edifice, postal savings system, postal insurance, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now, a couple of times, at least already, what has come up is the importance of a particular leader, right? The importance of an individual in shaping what comes next. And if there are, at least for me as a reader, if there are two among many important themes in this book that really stood out to me, one was the importance of timing. And I think you mentioned this explicitly in sort of dictating how the reforms that come up later in the book happen and why they happen and when they don't happen, why they don't happen, and so on and so forth. But also, and this is what I wanted to ask you a little bit about, the importance of clear and creative leadership of individuals. It's not, and this is something methodologically that's very striking, and it's not necessarily the case that you would have to tell a story this way. And so for you, can you talk a little bit about that, about the importance of individuals to this story and the, the decisions and the personalities of individuals, one of whom is Koizumi we haven't talked about yet, but he's there from the beginning and he'll be a powerhouse at the end.
First, a caveat. When you talk about Japanese politics, with only a few exceptions, you don't normally talk about innovative leaders. It's not something that stands out in the way politics is conducted in Japan today in particular. But the postal system, if you look through its history, and it's nearly 150 years now, the modern postal system, there are just three people who stand out, but they stand out in really, really important ways. And that's Maiji Mahisoka, Tanaka Kakue, and finally Koizumi Junichiro, who tries to undo all the handiwork of Maijima and Tanaka. But they're not important just because they wanted to do something about the post office. They're important because of the times in which they operate. And I think it's really important to see that Maijima had a blank slate, really, to do almost what he wanted with the post office because there was no precedent really to build on. There was a little, but I don't want to overstate that point. But he had a carte blanche, basically, to invent a postal system on his own accord. And he did that almost single-handedly, some support from other key people. So he was the main architect, and his imprint on the services and his imprint it really carries through the entire modern era to the postal system. Tanaka Kakue was also operating in a really important time. He was operating in a historical juncture that gave him the power to make changes. And that juncture was the formation of the Liberal Democratic Party. In the immediate aftermath of 1955, the Liberal and Democratic parties come together and form one large conservative party. And he just happens to be in the party at that time, climbing the ladder of power within the party, and uses his own bailiwick to build these bases of support and just moves into the postal realm by virtue of being one of the first post-1955 ministers of post-telecommunications. So he uses that position to bring the postmasters and the LDP together. In the early 2000s, when Koizumi comes along, it's a much different period, and the aspirations of politicians are much different, whereas Tanaka wanted to bring the LDP closer to the postal system and solidify the institutions of the post office. Koizumi aimed to do the opposite. He wanted deregulation. He wanted neoliberal reform. He wanted to privatize the postal services, and he wanted to free the LDP from the stranglehold of vested interests, the postmasters being just one of those vested interests. And what gave him the wherewithal to do that was not just his own personality. He was a strong and iconic and innovative leader who wasn't afraid of taking huge risks, unlike some of his predecessors and successors. But he was really one of the first politicians to take those risks and fully take advantage of the new institutions that were in place in the political system, a new electoral system that had been in place since 1994, and new institutions introduced under the Hashimoto administration of the 1990s to strengthen the cabinet within the government. And he used both the elections, the new electoral system, and the new cabinet institutions to really sidestep old customs for making policies. He sidestepped old interest groups. He ignored other power centers. And he charted his own course using these new institutions of the cabinet to create a major new policy for privatizing the postal system. And he basically rammed it down the throats of the LDP by using the 1994 electoral system in new and innovative ways. When the LDP ultimately said no at the 11th hour to his postal reforms, he called a snap election. This is a famous story now. And refused the endorsement of the LDP to all those LDP politicians who had voted against his privatization bills. So he was able to pass postal privatization. And that was in 2005. But he wouldn't have been able to do what he did if it hadn't been for these new institutions, both within the executive branch of government and within the electoral system. If they hadn't been in place, he wouldn't have made nearly that amount of progress. There were others in the past that toyed with the idea of making changes to the postal system that didn't succeed, in part because they didn't have the backing of these institutions. So I really think innovative leadership depends on not just the leaders, but also the institutional setting in which they're operating. And that really fits into sort of the historical timing. And in Koizumi's instance, he was able to create a formative moment in the history of the postal system by using these institutions in the way that he did. But I don't think you can chalk it up just to the individuals.
That's great. Thank you so much. And that's one of the things when writing about important and powerful, historically powerful individuals or individuals who are associated at least with important historical changes, it's a really delicate balance to write in such a way that you're both acknowledging the importance of the particular creative genius of this leader, but not letting that individual take over the whole story and not making it about right. One person. And I think you do that beautifully here. I mean, that's really, really hard to do. It's really hard to do.
I won't tell you how long it took me to write that book.
Well, it
took a long time.
It worked really well. And it's, like I said, it's, I think any of us who have tried to write about important individuals in history and write with sources that also lend themselves to acknowledging the importance of individuals will know how difficult that is to pull off. So well done.
Thank you.
So for listeners, because I don't want to keep you much more than an hour here. For listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book, I'll just mention as I blitz through this and blitz right to the end that there are really beautifully written chapters in the interim here that we're not going to talk about in detail, but that you've sort of mentioned along the way on sort of the lives and the workday lives and the history of these commissioned postmasters. That I think very wonderfully evoke these some of these interviews that you mentioned at the beginning. A really wonderful story of post-war reform, how that lays the foundation for the Hashimoto reforms, which you've mentioned, and then that how that in turn lays the foundation for the sort of the conclusion of the story, which is this story about how Koizumi is able to, in his institutional setting, affect these what sound like very sweeping reforms to the postal system and what happens afterwards. Now, he's a fascinating figure in the context of this book, in part because part of his leadership strategy seems to be that he repeatedly, and let me know if I'm wrong here, but he repeatedly almost sort of gives ultimatums, right? I mean, like, I'm going to leave, do this or else I'm going to resign.
And
do what he wants it to do, which is really wonderful. Now, this strategy works, and it works to affect really important change in the postal sector. What can you say a little bit about what were some of the ways that Koizumi is able to dramatically change this postal system, and how does that look from the perspective of right now? Sort of what's happened to these reforms that he was able to affect?
Good question. The legislation that was passed in 2005 sets the stage for the beginning of the privatization of the postal services in 2007, October 2007. The mail service will remain mostly government owned, but the privatization pertains only to the financial services, postal savings, and postal insurance. And according to the original legislation, there are individual firms set up for each of these three services, plus a fourth firm that oversees the network of post offices. And all of those are overseen by what's called Japan Post Holdings, a government-owned holding company. And from 2007, starting in 2011, it was supposed to start until 2017, the holding company was to gradually divest itself of the shares in the two financial services. And that was supposed to basically give postal savings and postal insurance to the market. Now, this has far-reaching ramifications for public finance in Japan. Now, there had been a reform introduced that went online in 2001 in which the rule that proceeds from postal savings and in insurance be automatically channeled into the FILP system was suspended. So basically, these services had independent investment authority. They could invest their funds in the private market if they wished. As it turned out, they continued to put their money into the post office system because it was safe, or into the FILP system because it was safe. And that's still going on today. Things begin to turn around a little when the LDP loses power in 2009. And there'd been a great deal of opposition toward postal privatization from within the LDP, from the forces of resistance, as Koizumi called it, and also from the Democratic Party of Japan and one of its coalition partners, which was a party of rebels that had been kicked out of the party in that 2005 election called the People's New Party. And the two parties got together and they decided that they were going to represent the postmasters. And one of the first things that they would do if they were to win that election would be to freeze the postal privatization process. And that's precisely what they did. The postmasters helped bring them to power. They weren't the only reason by any stretch of the imagination. And as partly to reward the postmasters and other friends of the old postal system, but also because a lot of people in the DPJ felt very strongly that Koizumi had gone too far, they froze the sale of shares by Japan Post Holdings in the financial companies and also by the government in Japan Post Holdings. And that was to give the government time to create a new set of bills designed to revamp Koizumi's privatization process. And the original bills were really very radical, and they basically would have deprivatized the postal system. They were since modified in a way that was more palatable to more people. And just recently, a revised set of bills has passed the lower house of the Diet, and it's expected that the Diet will pass them. What this will do is change the nature of the corporate structure of the postal system. And in so doing, we'll get into great detail, it will strengthen the hand of the government within the postal financial services as well as make more efficient the dissemination of mail collection services. But the criticism of these bills is that they will empower the government far more than what Koizumi ever envisioned in the day-to-day running administration of the postal services. So in that sense, it's a backtrack from what Koizumi had hoped for. And they're also considered to be changes that will probably enable the postmasters to continue to play a political role in the future. Now they're no longer public servants, they're private citizens again, so they can openly participate in politics. And they're very critical of postal privatization, and that's been their main source of targeted political activism. So it looks like privatization will be started up again quite soon, and that the divestiture process will begin, but there will be a different post office than from what was etched in legislative stone in 2005. And it's interesting that the main reason why this process is occurring now in 2012 is that the DPJ and the PMP, the two coalition parties, and some of their allies in the LDP are both coming together on this reform process, sort of unprivatizing privatization, because they want to speed up the process of divesting funds in the postal system to help the state raise money for reconstruction in the Tohoku area in the wake of the earthquake and tsunami last year. So it's very interesting that a major natural disaster is what's jump-starting this reform process and putting privatization on a different track. Advocates of the reform say that it will probably create a more efficient corporate structure. Critics are worried that it will keep postal savings unnaturally large and therefore skew investment and savings trends within the financial system at large. And that is also attracting significant criticism from foreign critics as well. So it's a mixed bag, but I think the interesting thing is that the post office continues to be politically really controversial, although this latest rendition has not had been quite so colorful as when Koizumi was in power.
Thank you so much. I think that's a wonderful way to sort of bring us to a concluding part of this conversation. But I'll just mention very briefly, because the book does conclude, and you just mentioned also with a postscript that talks about the aftermath of this in the context of the earthquake and the tsunami and the nuclear incident. And I just wanted to mention, without asking you to talk any more necessarily about it, just for scholars of disaster studies, actually, this is something that may not be obvious, but repeatedly, or it may not be obvious to potential listeners who may not have read the book yet, but listeners who are interested in the history of disaster might find a lot of really interesting material in here, because you do mention repeatedly, not just in this postscript, but also throughout, we see the effects politically, institutionally, financially, in all kinds of ways of the Kanto earthquake, of other major events, and of the post-war, in a way that's very, very interesting for the history of disaster.
Right. Another one small anecdote, and I'm glad you brought this up because it's one of my favorite stories that comes out of the history. In the wake of the 1923 earthquake, a lot of banks had to, in Tokyo, which resulted in tens and tens of thousands of deaths and devastated the city, Tokyo and Yokohama. In the wake of that earthquake, banks closed their doors and they remained closed for many days. But the post office was open within a couple of days, actually some areas within 24 hours. And they agreed to give their clients access to their savings, even if their identification had been lost in the disasters. And this has later been sort of pumped up as one of the things that only a post office can do because of its close ties to local communities. And I found it very interesting that within 24 hours of the Tohoku disaster, Japan Post had on its website alerts that the post office would be open for business immediately after the disasters, and that clients could withdraw some of their funds on an emergency basis, even if they had lost all form of identification. So the banks were much slower to do that. So this is just a very small, but I think telling indicator of how this institution has enormous implications for national politics, national finance, et cetera, et cetera. But when all is said and done, it's really a local institution, and its main claim to fame is that it serves the people. And it's really showed how it's done that in the wake of the 2011 natural disasters.
Thanks so much, Patty. Well, we have I don't want to take up too much more of your time. This is a really wonderful book, and it's so rich, and there's so much of it that we didn't get a chance to talk to strictly because of time. Is there anything about the book for listeners who either may or may not yet have read the book that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but that you want to mention to put out there for our listeners?
I think what I tried very hard to convey in the book is how, even under Koizumi, the evolution of the post office is really deeply historically based, and that you can't understand what Koizumi has done without understanding some of the actions of his predecessors and of institutional reforms that really precede him. And that really extends way back into history. So I really, one of my main goals, it's not necessarily a theme of the book, but one of my main research goals, was to show the continuity of the post office. And also to show how, even though I approached it first as a political scientist and involved in political studies and also interested in political economy, the post office gets really in the middle of a culture war in Japan. And there is a culture war going on right now, and I think it's happening in Europe. It's a reaction to globalization. It's a reaction to neoliberal reform. It's also anti-profit. I find it very interesting, and sometimes I think it's exaggerated and portrayed in overly stark terms. But we see the post office in recent years really entering into this conflict, particularly in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, how the post office, for better or worse, and whether you buy this or not, for many people still stands for a more public-oriented set of institutions that's there to serve the people and not make money. And the other side of the coin is portrayed as those who are intent on globalization, liberalization, profit, neoliberal economic reform, a more business-oriented way of moving a political economy forward. Now, I think these two poles are exaggerated, I don't think reality is never carried out in that way. But I think it's really interesting to look at the history of the post office in that sort of traditional function versus modern economic development function, and see how those conflicts and those debates that are global in perspective really play out in the post office, and how they're sometimes changed in the context of what the post office performs.
Great, thank you. So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm actually interested in smaller projects. One of the sort of spin-offs from the book is that I'm developing into more of a set of articles is the role of interest groups in Japan and how they've changed over the last two decades. And I find it very curious that a lot of these interest groups are still significant in Japanese politics, even though we would expect them to have far less electoral significance because of some of the changes that have been introduced. So I want to explain that, and I'm sort of developing some articles to look at that. But I have a long-term project that is likely to involve some collaborative work with some of my very close colleague, that involves the political economy of food in Japan, and sort of Japan through the eyes of food. And that would get me very much back into interdisciplinary studies. I think be charting a far more different course. And if we ever talk about that book in 10 years, if it ever comes out, I can say right now that it has absolutely nothing to do with the post office.
I can't wait. That sounds like a wonderful project, and let's make a date. So 10 years or so.
I hope I'm faster than that.
So Patty, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today. It's an extraordinarily rich book. It was absolutely a pleasure to talk with you about it and to read it, and best of luck with your current projects.
Thank you. And I want to thank you personally for your interest in my book. This was a great opportunity for me. And I enjoyed writing it so much. And I'm realizing now it's been a while since I've thought about it, that I was lucky. It was a great project. And I appreciate this chance to talk about it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And it really reads as a project that you enjoyed doing. And so as a reader, it was a pleasure.
Thanks. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much. And we'll see you next time.